Hey everybody, this is Matt here. Welcome back to Art Smack episode 22. Jerry is off this week. She is traveling to Chicago for Art Expo. Make sure you're following at Jerry Gagosian on Instagram to see updates from the event in Chicago this week. We got a great show for you nonetheless. It's a Matt solo pod. Boo. But don't worry, Jerry will be back next week. In the meantime, I'm going to be sharing an interview I did with one of the hardest working young artists I've had the pleasure of knowing, Mr. Ho J. Kim. But before we get into the interview, I want to talk to you guys about a project I've been working on, which is my newsletter. I launched a newsletter on Substack titled State of the Arts. And my mission with this newsletter is to discuss things around the art market, tech, finance, and how the three are interlocking every day. So far, there are three essays up. The first one was on art investment. The second one was structured around the debate on artist resale royalties. And the third one was about art market startups. And the third one is what I'm going to read to you guys before we get into the Ho J interview. The newsletter is available for free in the bio, matthewcapasso.substack.com. So give it a follow and hope you guys enjoy. The essay is entitled, Your Startup Probably Won't Change the Art World. New startups are making bold claims, but can they deliver on their lofty promises? What about the art world is so tantalizing to nouveau entrepreneurs? Every week, I read yet another new startup is looking to, quote, revolutionize, disrupt, or streamline the art world. It's true. The storied auction house Christie's recently even started an internal venture capital fund to invest in, quote, emerging technologies and fintech companies related to the art market. Something is brewing here. Is Silicon Valley's savior complex coming for the art world? Do any of these startups have a chance to establish a long-lasting foothold? Let's start by exploring the reasons why they could. The art market has a shit ton of problems. The goals of any new company should be A, to create a kick-ass product or service, and B, solve a real problem. Goal A is becoming increasingly accessible given the tools available to entrepreneurs today. We have no-code platforms that allow anyone with simple computer skills to create applications that can be deployed into viable technology products. For those applications that need a bit more human intervention, grab a software engineer. Although they're increasingly becoming more expensive, it doesn't matter when venture capital is still pouring millions into the early stage companies. Not to mention, we're in the opening innings of the artificial intelligence revolution, and the possibility of creating world-changing AI-driven tools seem more and more plausible. But what about goal B, solving a real problem? It's a bit more elusive. The art world struggles with a myriad of problems. Significant issues like access, inequality, education, and representation persist and are so difficult to tackle for a startup. It's probably, honestly, impossible. But there are the mundane and routine annoyances that every art world participant struggles with. These are potentially solvable. Is there a better, more reliable, more efficient, more convenient shipping solution? Same with business tools for galleries and artists, like inventory management and customer relationship management tools, also known as CRMs. Payments, marketing, accounting, contracts. I think these are all theoretically on the table. These functions find plenty of startup solutions in industries outside of the art world, so they should work inside. Some have tried and found niche levels of success. I've heard from gallerists that inventory management software like Artbase or ArtLogic are quite good. These tools help galleries manage their inventory, generate invoices, and do many operational things that keep the gallery's lights on. I'll chop this one up to a win. Uovo, a relative newcomer in the art shipping space, has gained significant traction. Based on reports that I've read, they're growing rapidly, hiring like crazy, and diversifying their business into different revenue channels. all signs of a thriving company. So inventory management and shipping have definitely benefited from fresh startup approaches. And I would mention that inroads are being made with other functions like contracts and payments, etc. But these marginal and ancillary activities are dwarfed by the real meat and potatoes of the art world. Transactions. Of all the economic activities in the art world, the physical act of buying or selling artworks is the greatest creator of economic value, particularly the buying and selling of secondary market works of art by household blue chip artists. Think about it. A standard fee for buying or selling on behalf of a client starts at 10% and goes up. When the work of art is selling in the millions or tens of millions of dollars, you can clearly see the huge economic upside. In this arena of transactions, the nouveau tech disruptors have yet to find traction compared to the entrenched auction and gallery competitors. Artsy, the most visible digital-first marketplace for artworks, has raised over $100 million in venture capital since its beginnings in 2009. The company has done an excellent job marketing itself, as it's nearly a household name brand within art circles. Is it a profitable endeavor? No one knows, but my guess is not. All of this to say, startups have seen varied success, aka failure, in tackling transactions in the art market. Here are a few potential reasons why. One, limited market size. Though a $67.8 billion per year industry, according to the investment bank UBS, the art market is still relatively small when you put it into perspective. The art market is roughly the same size as the market for wedding services like photography or catering, fantasy football, and the adhesives and sealants industry. Not the most thrilling peer group. Further, the yearly growth for the art market year over year is moving at a snail's pace. It's up 3%, 1-2-3%, from 2021 to 2022. It'll be a long time before the art market materializes into a mass consumption industry. For some context, the market size per year for healthcare around the globe is $11.9 trillion. Construction, $7 trillion. Renewable energy, $1 trillion and growing fast. Chicken, poultry products, $300 billion. Reason number two, complex relationships. The art market relies heavily on personal relationships, trust, and reputation. Startups and their founders, being newbies, need help to establish the necessary credibility to convince established players like blue chip art dealers to adopt their tech-enabled solutions. After all, we all know the art world is like a members-only club, and outsiders are by default subject of skepticism. And lastly, number three, resistance to change. The art world is known for its traditions and long-standing customs, albeit unregulated and reliant on handshakes, which can make it resistant to technological disruption and innovation. This resistance makes it difficult for startups to gain any traction or find willing collaborators. The established players have their own way of doing things that they've defined over decades to great success. An old mantra comes to my mind: if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Side note, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the players in the emerging immersive and augmented reality art genre startup space. New ways to view art by the public are being created and heavily invested in. The most visible of these is Superblue, which, if recent reports of board coups and succession-esque turmoil are true, hasn't had the smoothest ride in its nascent run. Augmented reality startups promise artists a new way to connect with the public. But as Facebook/Meta is finding out the hard way, the current offers for augmented and virtual reality just aren't compelling enough for consumers. So, There are some marginal ways for disruptors to build better mousetraps for the ancillary activities related to the art market. Things like shipping, inventory, accounting. These tamed small-scale operations could even do it successfully and profitably. But all of this is probably window dressing. So far, the 800-pound gorilla of buying and selling artwork transactions remains unimpressed and unmotivated to change. So the next time ArtNet or ArtNews or whomever releases a puffy profile of the latest entrepreneur wonder kid promising to, quote, disrupt the world, ask yourself this. That's cool, but what if we solve the problems in climate, healthcare, and education first? And that's the essay. Appreciate you guys listening. Without further ado, here is my interview with artist Ho J. Kim. All right, everybody. Ho J., welcome to Art Smack. How you doing, my man?
How are we? How are you, Matt?
I'm doing well, sir. I'm doing well. What you got? Where are you right now? I see some paintings in the background.
I am in my studio. I'm just coming back from brunch. Had a good, fun date with a really good friend. Like, it's more of a family friend, so don't get the wrong idea.
Well, actually, but your studio looks pretty empty right now, which is, by the way, I've been to your studio a few times now. I've never seen it this empty. What's going on?
Right. As you know, recently I had a solo show opening at Harper's in their Chelsea location, occupying both of their Chelsea spaces on, edit me if I'm wrong, but I think it's on the 22nd Street. I don't have it memorized by heart.
So I want to get into the show for sure, but I feel like I should give more background as to our relationship, because I was listening to some of the older Art Smack interview episodes, and it's like we always tell the story of how we met the guest right at the top. So I just want to stick with the theme. The year 2019, I'm working at Christie's. By day, I'm structuring consignments as a commercial advisor, doing loans and derivatives, which is like gets its own other podcast episode in the future. But by night, I had volunteered along with a coworker named Celine Kuhn-Ha to chair this organization at Christie's called, bear with me, the Corporate Social Responsibility Employee Initiative Equity, Diversion, and Inclusion Group. Did I get that right? I feel like it's such a
isn't it short? Like, don't you just call yourself CSR?
We just called it CSR, but that was
that's how I've been calling it. Yeah.
What we wanted to do was exhibit emerging artists in Christie's space and use the Christie's platform and marketing machine and sales tools to just host a cool event, all for charity. In 2019, we put out a call. We were like, if anyone knows any artists that want to do a submission, please get in touch with us. Here's the email. We sent it to all the Christie's staff and they sent it out to their network. And I got an email one day from a Mr. Ho J. Kim, cold email we had never met. And in that email, you gave me a resume and you gave me some images of your work and you gave me some work that was available for the exhibition. And in there was it was like an 18 foot painting, the movie theater seats.
Oh, right. That was 12 feet.
It's only 12. Why in my head did I think it was 18? Anyway, it was big. And I remember looking at it and being like, I want this. We had the Christie's entire Rockefeller Center first floor. We had the space for it. And I figured we needed something for the show that was like big and powerful. And of course the higher up said, no, thank you. We can't do it. But nevertheless, we still wanted to have you in the show. Opening night, I remember you sitting in front of your paintings, talking to a whole bunch of people, selling work. I think it went to one of the big investment banks, Corporate Collections that night.
It was a JP Morgan art collection to Anna and Charlotte, right?
Yeah.
Who are really great people, by the way. Oh, man. Yeah. Lovely people.
So that was a big night, I remember, for you. And it was like, I was so busy running around, but I could see you just in the thick of it, selling yourself. And I was like, awesome. This is, that dream has been visualized. And ever since then, we've just kept up a relationship. Like, we've done a few Christie's projects together. You're now having this solo career. So did I get our story right? Is there anything I'm missing from it?
No, it's good. I think it's pretty accurate. But that's our origin story, right? And this was before you went sober, so we had more cocktails in between.
Oh, yeah. That was we used to go out and just, I mean, a big thing, and I wanted to get to it with our discussion, is like, dude, you can cook.
And I can drink that there's one night where I think I drank like 12 martinis in front of you. That night I passed out halfway in the doorway. So I woke up with my torso inside my building, but with my legs still like in the doorway. So I was a liminal person between doorways and just sleeping.
Well, speaking of liminal, when I first time I asked you about your work at the Christie's show, I remember this very vividly. We were on the subway platform or something, and we were talking about your work, and you started to bring up liminal spaces as this concept. And could you just rehash that? You know, at that time, the framework of which you were creating work was all about liminal spaces.
Yeah, it is still something that I am working with, and I've been coining it as purgatory. Just, I think it was like a more, it's like a thematic way of coining the idea of in-between spaces, liminal spaces, or non-spaces. So purgatory is a religious term, and in multiple versions of theologies, purgatory is often a place a person arrives after death before they go to their respective heaven or hell. It's like a place of limbo. But beyond the religious, I think there are many moments of purgatory in our everyday lives. Many people in the art world are always flying between countries. You know, like, for example, when I fly to Korea, which is between 14 and sometimes 19 hours, you are neither here nor there, but you exist somewhere, you know, and it's very, you know, like stuck in a space that simultaneously exists and doesn't exist. In New York, there are things like MTA, like what is train traffic? Like, just conceptually doesn't make sense. But you know, like you may there are places while in, you know, transit that you may feel stuck. You know, on the streets there are endless scaffolds and construction. You know, do we ever see the beginning or the end of construction, especially in metropolitan areas? We don't, but we're always just existing somewhere during a construction. But you know, like, but even beyond physical locational things, you know, like, Matt, you and I are lucky enough to be doing something that we're passionate about. But you know, majority of people or demographics in the world, many are bound by circumstances, whether it's, you know, like social, financial, geographical. Like, most people in the world live constrained. And oftentimes, because of these restrictions, people aren't able to, you know, fully pursue their dreams. You know, I think a lot of people are detached or displaced from their true desire. And I think, in a way, their hamster wheel-like lifestyle, I think something that I've also lived through for a long time before I fortunately became a full-time artist, I think those can also be seen as purgatories. And for me, my audiences are important for me. Part of it is me making the work for myself, but I also understand that when these are hung in galleries and on walls, when they're in public places, there are audiences, you know? And I think in acknowledgement of my audiences, I wanted to make artworks that became more available, perhaps legible or understandable, you know, like, while not flattening out the complexities that can be in art. And that was a reason for me to look for something that I think was empathetic or available to more than just the people in the art world. And, you know, like, the idea of purgatory or idea of in-between spaces, like the type of action you do in these domains the action you take is to wait. And it's hard to say anything is universal, but perhaps the act of waiting is a universal gesture that we can all, you know, like, empathize with.
I couldn't agree more. And one of my favorite themes, I guess, from your earlier work was the cornfields. I thought that was a great story where you had in a lot of your works, there was these surreal like scenes and cornfields were in the background. And those were coming from, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's because you were traveling across the country.
Yeah.
You're amazed about how many cornfields there are in between here and California. Just endless.
Exactly.
And that's that purgatory space. That's that in between space or that liminal space.
Yeah, in New York, we have the MTA, and in the rest of America, there are cornfields, you know.
Or also bathrooms, too. I've seen a lot of bathrooms or, you know, stalls, public restrooms in your work, too.
And yeah, yeah.
It's just different ways to connect with the audience, because I do agree. I do think waiting and purgatory is very a universal feeling. Like, and I think that's why your work has resonated with so many people.
I hope so. Yeah.
You're also another heavy influence in your work that I've seen that I'd love to hear you unpack for us is literary. I mean, I think you're a voracious reader. You're also a writer, which I want to get into too. But tell me a little bit about how books and authors have influenced your work too. Like in your latest show with Harper's, there's a work that's very clearly a nod to Don Quixote.
When I was in college, one of the things that my professor always told me was like, Hoje, you have like art ADHD. It's because like there was a time when I realized that I knew absolutely nothing, like nothing about like art history. I didn't understand a lot of things. So my reaction to it, or my reaction to that acknowledgement, was to absorb as many things as possible. And by the time I was a senior in college, like I was making a lot of works, but like everything looked different. Like they all looked like they were made from different people. And then eventually I had a very difficult time like figuring out like what actually was. And that was actually solved in New York because of constraint of time and money, because of like I had to work a lot of like hospitality jobs. So there's such a limited amount of time in the studio and more time to think. I think that's when it just like pragmatically happened, like this the simplification. But I think like eventually what helped for me was to find a common denominator in all the things that were interesting to me, you know. And I think for me, part of it was to think about what this purgatory or what this idea of in between means, and how, and then I guess from there on, whenever I found something that resembled that, whether it's from books, movies, philosophical texts, or even personal experiences, I think I noticed them more. And if the idea just stayed in my head for long enough, then I think it became a cue for me to start sketching it out. And when the sketches look interesting enough to me, then I bring it into my studio and then start working on it more formally through like pen, pencil, and then computer programs. Since you brought Don Quixote, one way of seeing that character is to see him as a being who exists beyond Freud, meaning that he is beyond genealogy. You know, in a Freudian sense, every person is a result of a mother and a father, and also a whole lineage of family line. Whereas Don Quixote is a character, or is a person who read too many books and got so like into it that he went crazy, and he chose an identity for himself. So like, sure, there is like birth and creation, but it's not of his mother or father, but from the ideas that he really loved and embodied. And I thought, in a way, that was kind of like what artists are, you know?
Yeah.
Like we all have our origins, our traumas and joys, and you know, family history. But ultimately, I think like whether you are writing, painting, making music, there, I think there's a point in time when you get so aroused or attracted to a discipline or an idea, this feeling that you just can't let go of, and then you choose an identity for yourself, like regardless of what other people say. And then, for a long time, people may think that you're crazy, like Don Quixote. You might see monsters when others see windmills, but in a way, that is your truth or that is your belief. And if you're lucky enough, if you're able to find yourself at the right place with enough discipline, then other people may see, monsters instead of windmills. But another interpretation of it, I worked in the hospitality industry for about 10 years. I did all things like I washed dishes, I was a waiter, I was a manager, I was a bar director. I tried a lot of different things, all to support my like emerging art career. And similar to Don Quixote, during the day, I wore a skin that was different from who I really was. I think during the day, I wore the skin of a restaurant manager or a hospitality person. And for a very long time, people saw me not as like the true Ho Jae Kim, but people saw me as the rest as a restaurant manager, Ho Jae Kim. In a weird way, there was a displacement from self. Like I fully embody like my dreams and my goals, and I know who I am. But the rest of the world sees me differently. And after my restaurant shift at night, I would go home. And during my night shift, my true shift, I was able to, become or wear the skin that truly belonged to me. So in regards to identity and like outside perspective, I think Don Quixote is like an interesting analogy to see what an artist is.
Right.
So
That makes a lot of sense. And I feel like one of the things Jerry and I have talked about on the last few podcasts is the idea that it shouldn't be frowned upon for an artist to have a day job, especially when living in New York. And even if that practice, that work is not in the arts per se, it's just to get by or something that they may have a passive passion in, it doesn't stop them from being an artist. Like, did you ever during that time when you were working in the restaurants think you're not an artist?
So, I mean, one, I definitely agree with you. New York is so expensive. I mean, it is great being here, but it's also really expensive. It's not that I never thought that I was an artist when I had a day job. But like there are times when you are just fully immersed in a different world and you're just wearing a different hat. And I think there was also times when I thought of not painting anymore. Because the managing job was like so demanding, but it was also just doing really well. I was like really getting to know the industries, the people, the network. So I think in a way, like these day jobs can become bigger than your passion at times, and it can become more desirable. And I think there's nothing wrong with it. I have plenty of friends who have switched their directions. I almost had also. It's I think at the end of the day, it's about choice and like what will make you happier.
I was going to say before on Don Quixote, now that you've explained it, I do see the connection to your practice. It's more philosophical, it's more deep. But then also in your work, I just wanted to tell the audience, there's one of my favorites is a reference to Tom Hanks's Castaway of Wilson. You have the volleyball Wilson in one of your paintings. Like that is like the on the nose Castaway limbo space. So that's where you're pulling from the film references, along with something as weighty as Don Quixote as a post-Freudian character. I think it's great.
So like there are definitely heavier subjects like Cervantes, but they're also more casual or funnier references too. I think the overall point is that like once in a while I come across a story that I can just like fully immerse myself in and find these interesting dynamics. The source can be as a classic and traditional and dense, but like it can also be like as casual as the movie Castaway or the toilet, you know, like a shitter, you know?
No, I
Yeah.
see it. So you got steeped in the restaurant industry, and as I mentioned at the top of the pod, like you can damn cook. Like, we're not talking about putting together a casual meal with friends. I mean, you have some real technique and skill, and I would call you a culinary artist as well as a fine artist. Has your practice in the culinary arts, sorry to be cliche, influenced your work in visual arts slash fine arts and vice versa?
I guess this is a cool thing for ArtsMack listeners because there's actually a secret project that I'm working on right now with a chef. I won't reveal what the restaurant is yet, but the idea that I'm working on is called the Herculean Dinner. So Hercules is in his mythology, Hercules has to complete 12 impossible tasks to obtain his freedom. And the chef and I are producing a 12-course meal. And when you, as the diner or dinner guest, finishes all 12 courses or quote unquote 12 tasks, then you, the audience, becomes Hercules. So it's like I was thinking of how to, you know, like bring creative narrative structure into the experience of food that we, you know, like we just take as granted. And I think another interesting thing about Hercules is that a lot of pop culture sees him as the super masculine blonde hero. But if you actually listen to like the unabridged version of his mythology, he's actually a character who is cursed from his
His
father's
wife,
sin.
well,
Yeah, so
his
like
wife, yeah, Zeus's wife was like the one who
Hera.
wanted,
So
yeah.
yes, yeah, so like Hera, which is technically Achilles' stepmother, is like pissed off at it, just hates them, like hates his existence
Yeah,
because he's
because Zeus was
a
cheating
product
with
of
wait, I'm about to say Zeus was cheating with every pretty girl in ancient Greece, and Hera was getting pissed off.
Yeah, exactly. So again, in a Freudian sense, Hercules is caught between like his father's sins and his mother's hatred, like from his genealogy. He is like cursed to live this laborious life without freedom. And in addition to more like humane like characteristics like short temper and stuff, like he just gets into a lot of crap. You know, and the 12 labors are his way to redemption, but to ultimately die and have a tragic death, you know? And I think that part of labor and like trying to free ourselves from sins that are not of our own, I think it's an interesting narrative. But also for the guests to become Hercules, I think that's an interesting thing to just throw out there. I think it'll be a cool press piece also, maybe.
One of the things when we did the Christie's CSR projects is we dreamt of doing an exhibition that combined visual arts in the emerging scene with culinary arts and fine dining. And we always thought that was a perfect pairing because naturally the audience that is really into cooking or going to nice restaurants would also be the same that would be into, for the most part, going to see a great gallery show or, you know, going to an art fair, et cetera, which led us to launch this thing called At the Table, which was one of our later exhibitions we did at Christie's CSR, which was your baby.
Definitely. Yeah, so this was 2020, was it? I think it was late 2020 or early 2021. This is after I met you and Celine, and we were hot into COVID, right?
Deep.
Coronavirus.
We
We
were
were
in the thick of it.
we were in the center of quarantine. And at the time I had an idea because you know, growing up, especially in art school, as an artist, they teach you to look for, you know, like better truth or better lives or care about humanity. As artists, you come to truly embody that. But at the same time, when I was growing up or when I was in school, there wasn't as many resources for my community, Asian American, Pacific Islander communities. And that became more apparent, I think, during COVID. Everyone had a very difficult time, but I think it was also a very significant time for my community. And part of the reason why it became so apparent was because during COVID, I hope to find a place where I can just be, where like people will just empathize and just like help me just understand how I feel. And especially in the art space, it was hard to find that at the time. So knowing you and Celine, and knowing that Christie's CSR departments do these more philanthropic programs, I wrote you guys a pitch to create a program to support the API community. And in our initial stages, we talked about, like this and that. And Matthew, I think we started talking about food, right? How we can, is there a way to bring food into the equation? And I think in that moment, like something really clicked for me, because the program that I wished to bring at the time was not only celebratory and empathetic, but also educational. Because I think part of these like humanitarian programs is to, one, give moment of peace and empathy for people who are in the community, the one that we're working for. But I think for the greater future, there also has to be an educational part where we are able to teach these dense narratives and histories to people who may yet be familiar, right? Because oftentimes, not all the time, but oftentimes people are, like not as supportive, not because they're evil, but because they're not as aware as people who are in the center of it. So for me, I was wondering, what is something that is both empathetic and educational? And when we started talking about food, that really hit me, because the experience of sharing a food, the experience of sitting at a table with somebody, it's a very natural place for you to even your perspectives and just start talking about anything, whether it's to break the ice or just to just fully let out your insides, whatever it is. A table is a place where just stories are shared, where perspectives are met. And in a way, this dense idea of education becomes very casual and just easily accepted. And also, when you travel to a new country, one of the best ways to learn about something new is through food. So I thought food, in addition to art, could be a great medium to bring cultural education and awareness. And I think from there, we decided to name the program At the Table.
Do you remember how like we wrangled with so many names and like logos? And we were like bouncing around. It was always like we wanted something with a table, but we couldn't figure out the phrasing. And then I think it was Sarah McKay. Shout out Sarah if she's listening, was the one who came up with At the Table. And we were like, done, let's do it. I think we were so spent at that point. We were like, let's just go with it.
But it's a good title. I really like it. Through the program, we're able to generate over $200,000. Half of it went back to the artists who are participating, and the other half donated to Heart of Dinner. And we also published a cookbook
Oh, yeah.
with family recipes, little bits of writings and art inside. In addition to all of that, like we found a small nonprofit organization named Civil Art. We are continuing these types of programs. So this summer, this July in Chelsea, we are collaborating with another small nonprofit organization called the Here and There Collective under this new civil arts initiative called Art and Voices. It's a program where we demonstrate camaraderie and friendship and unity between different organizations that work to bring social awareness to minority groups. And yeah, we're going to be recreating a big show in a Chelsea gallery, followed by other events. And back to Christie's, Christie is super happy with At the Table. And we are going to be doing another rendition in 2024. I don't know how detailed I can talk about it yet, but the show itself is confirmed. And this time they are giving us a lot of support.
Nice.
And with the amount of, time that we have left, and also the amount of, I think, corporate sponsorships and relationships that I was able to build in the last few years, I think we can do a really good job, something even more spectacular.
Yeah.
And thank you and Celine for initially accepting this idea, which really blossomed over time.
It was a wild time. It was like my first time ever curating projects. Like I was like a numbers guy at Christie's, like that was what I was hired to do. I had come from finance world and business school. And I was like, let me take this cool job in this space that I find interesting. And I remember telling some friends that I had met in the artist community of New York that I was working at Christie's. And the looks on their faces when I told them I worked at Christie's was so much disgust and like animosity. Because I think the mentality, maybe it still is within some artists, but the mentality at that time was like, Christie's fucking sucks. They flip our art. They don't care about emerging artists. They just pump and dump. And to some extent, there's a lot of that energy. But I kept thinking when I would hear that, like, nah, man, like, I don't want you to think that I work at a place that does that. So like the whole mentality, at least for me, was how do I get those people, those artists in New York to like Christie's? And I was like, let's use Christie's to exhibit them. And that was like literally the whole idea was just like, how do I get people to stop making fun of me that I work at this place? But let's turn the page to what's going on today. So the Harper's Show, it's launched, it's up. You've been working on this one for a long time. Tell me about the process and the buildup, and then what it feels like to finally see that exhibition come to life.
Well, to summarize it, it felt like I took a really big shit. I feel like I feel like I've been constipated for more than a year, and I just like let it all out. And it feels good. I feel relieved. I'm very happy. So to prepare the show, I drew for about 2-3 months. And then I painted for about a year. And I've produced a total 22 paintings. One is 17 feet wide. The other one is, I forget the exact number, but I think it's around like 8 feet tall-ish. And then the remaining 20 paintings are 50 inches by 40 inches.
So you finally took that shit, right? It happened. Yeah. By all means, it was a successful show. Like, and I wanted to ask you about success. How do you define it when it comes to being an artist?
Yeah, it's a hard question.
It's the only kind we ask on Art Smack, dude.
Yeah. Well, I guess if success is this like really big general term, I guess underneath that there is, it's like one is like, was it financially successful? And another one is like, does it make me happy? Or like, am I proud of it? Or like, what does it do to your soul? And I guess it's a balance of it, right? And I guess my true happiness is that I didn't have to sacrifice either of the spectrum. And that somehow conditions were met to the very possible best. I think that's what makes me truly happy, because the show was very conceptually driven. There are a lot of like very personal references that I made, like really integral to the project. I actually wrote the press release myself.
Really?
And yeah, and none of the concepts or the paintings were sacrificed for any financial means, but it was also very financially successful to me. So I think what I'm happy about is that somehow I was able to have the best of both worlds, and it definitely has opened up a lot of new doors. And also it motivates me to, you know, like do more, you know, like go get even more ambitious.
I've always been curious. Do you as an artist look to other artists as a model for a art career? Like, is there an artist out there that you're like, wow, I would want their career? Like, that's the kind of path I want to take. You don't have to say who, but like, or if you want to say who, I think that'd be super interesting. But like, do artists think that way? Because I do feel like actors sometimes, they say they want to have a career of like, I don't know, Bradley Cooper or something, who started to direct when he was in his 40s. I don't know. Do you ever think like that?
Yeah, you know, like, I think people are going to scoff when I say this, but I think Picasso is like a great reference for like what a career could be.
Okay.
Because like to me, yes, he has all these like mythologies that's created around him. But like, I think like not only did he make great artworks, but I think like he had the brains to create a great like ethos or narrative around him. You know, like, it's almost like his self became like the product, you know? I mean, like, I'm sure it happened over like histories and, you know, like books that were written about him. But, you know, I think he was definitely someone who could market himself really well. Whereas like Dolly is like someone who's great, but like his wife really took an advantage of him. You know, like, I think his like wife was like his business manager, but someone who also like exploited him. So like, I don't know if you know the story, but like towards the end of his life, like he was like running out of money. Like, I think like he signed a bunch, he like Dolly himself signed a bunch of like blank paper and sold those. You know, like, I don't know, like, I think Picasso, you know, I think Picasso is a good model in a way, I think, where he was a both good salesman and an artist.
Yeah. Are you aware that there's a current movement that started? There's a book forthcoming that's going to talk about his indiscretions as a womanizer, perhaps leaning towards abuser. I'm not reporting it. I'm just, you know, rehashing what the book is about to say, because there was a piece, I think, in The Economist that was talking about this upcoming book where basically like the knives are out for Picasso now. And it was, I mean, clearly the guy had a lot of relationships with women. Women were at the center of a lot of his periods and movements. But apparently the story is a little darker, according to this reporter.
Oh, like how dark? Like,
we'll have to read the book, but The Economist.
Like, is he another Kevin Spacey?
Nah, I don't know. It was, you know, it could be one of those things where it was of the time, or it could be one of those things where someone was really inappropriate. I don't know the whole details yet, but it is forthcoming on Picasso. We'll probably cover it when that book comes out. I'll give it a read because I'm very curious to see how it goes.
Yeah, let me know what the book is, and then I'll give it a read too. I mean, like, those things definitely make me want to, you know, like, keep distance to it. I mean, distance from him. But I think the point I was trying to make was that, like, I like artists who were not only great painters, but also was able to create some kind of like good like business mythology around them.
Yeah.
Because I think that is also like a huge part of the artist's career. You know, like how, like controlling how people see you. Like, or like, I think like you're almost building a character, right? Like, not to say that, oh, like, I'm not saying that artists should create a fake facade, but I think as an artist, like, there are times when you can become hyper aware of what you stand for.
I think brand comes to mind.
Yeah, artists definitely.
Like to define a brand, whether stylistically or in how they behave or even how they dress. Like, brand building is certainly something central to mythologies of artists. Definitely. I think that's why Dali walked on the street with the aardvark. That's a real thing that happened. I think that happened, right? I've seen photos.
He did a lot of stuff. I mean, like, he created movie sets and stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Or Warhol with the factory or any of these types of things. It was like an exercise in brand building. I think artists today are certainly doing it too. On one hand, you have like Kaws, who's like built a brand, like a IP commoditized brand. but also other artists, I think like Hank Willis Thomas or others that through their work are creating an identity and a brand. And it's certainly something that goes hand in hand with just the work, no?
You know, I think a lot of these are like chicken or egg kind of stuff. But at the same time, I think there are artists when they're kind of in the process, they're aware of it. And there are times when you can utilize that to have like some control of it, you know, whether like you actively choose to like be part of like or collaborate with Hollywood things, or whether you like really embody like philanthropy and nonprofit and like really make, you know, like helping others part of your like studios things. Or it could be as, or like with Bad Choices, it could be something bad, like the book that you're describing to me, you know, like, because even if you don't mean it, like it could become part of your brand, right?
How would you define your brand, Hojay?
I think I'm too young.
That's a good answer.
Yeah.
So
we'll have this talk again, maybe in a few decades.
So do you, after a big show like this, right, do you start to worry anyway about the market, about this next stage of your career, protecting yourself? Like, do those thoughts creep in at all? And have they for you?
All the time, I think. All the time.
Yeah.
I think young artists are always afraid of their works getting flipped, you know? And also, like, I think, like, I also wonder, or I think a lot of emerging artists also wonder, like, how long will their careers last, right? But at the same time, you just have to keep going, you know? You never know until the day comes. You never know when it will happen. So I think, like, for me personally, I just keep moving forward. I try my best to make the best kinds of relationships with and professional friends. I think these relationships really do matter. I'd like to think right now that I have a lot of amazing people around me who in addition to helping my career, also help me with like my personal things when at times when they're needed. I don't want to get too specifically into that, but I like to think that I'm in good hands. And although I can't be 100% confident, I think there's some assurance where I think I have some cushions, if that's the right way to put it. Or I think another way to think about these like things is that, you know, like I think it's especially when you're younger, just because how things are taught to you, I think a lot of people focus on quantifiable qualities. But I think as you grow older, you realize that both quantifiable and qualitative qualities are like both necessary.
Right.
And like whether it's the art world or other industries, you know, like quantities or like monetary things are important, but also like the way businesses and things work, you know, like it's at the end of the day, it's people business. It's about relationships, you know, like who are willing to work with you or who are willing to support you even when you're going through hard times. And like, I don't want to say who, but like there are people who only focused on the quantitative parts and are having a hard time a few years later, like when like the market stuff is happening, you know. So I think like for my humanity also, but also I think strategically thinking, I think I've been doing my due diligence in both qualitative and quantitative things. Right. With developments. And I'm hoping that I can keep it up. You know, I'm hoping that I can stay being a both good producer of art, but also a good human being. And we'll see where that goes. But
I think you're a good human being, my man. Don't worry. I don't think we have anything to worry about that. Couple more questions. Have you started painting again? Are you
Yes, I started the week after the show.
That's what Hiba said. It feels like there's a bug within people. I just know myself. Like if I grind on something for like a year, like the last thing I want to do a week later is to reboot and start up again. But I guess it's, if it's coming from, you know, if it is your creative practice, it's like you almost can't avoid it, can you?
Yeah, it's like, you know, like it's actually more assuring to be in the studio than to be outside wandering around for too long. I feel like if I want to take a real break, I have to go somewhere far.
Right.
And like do like a real quote unquote vacation. Like I have to be like my studio has to be unapproachable, you know. But I also have a lot of group shows and another solo show coming up later this year. So I think also just production wise, I had to come back to the studio.
So final question for you, Hojay. If you could go back in time to and speak with the Hojay Kim that was working in restaurants by day and painting at night, what's a piece of advice that you would give to him in your position now?
Let's say
that, remember that Hojay who was debating on whether to keep creating work and being.
Yeah. Painful. I would say keep doing you, but also be kinder to yourself. And like it was because it was important to keep, you know, pursuing and doing. But I think I sacrificed myself a lot, whether it was for painting or for other relationships. But I think I would tell them to take a little more break. You'll probably live longer and get less sick.
I think I was thinking about that since I've known you. I don't think you've ever taken a vacation, or I haven't seen you like traveling at all. You've just been in the studio.
Yeah, I'm just like so not used to it. So I think after this upcoming solo show in November, I think I'm going to go somewhere. I don't know where, but I will go somewhere.
Well, no one's earned it more than you. So Hojay, where can people find your work, you know, plug your website and talk a little bit more about, you know, where is your solo project coming up and how can people check it out?
Yeah, I guess I'll give you some current and lined up things. As you know, right now it's the solo show is at Harper's in Chelsea. Uh-huh. I have a painting that was sent to Make Room Gallery in LA with Amelia.
Yeah.
I think it's opening in the upcoming week. I'm working with Canal Project. It's a nonprofit space. And then I have a solo exhibition coming up in LA with Nicodeme Gallery. I think that should be fun. I think thematically it would be an extension of the current show. Not exactly the same, but I think in dialogue with it. I guess like to give you a preview. In Dante's term, the current show at Harper's Carousel, it covers both the Inferno and Purgatory. And I think for the Nicodeme show, title is working, but the paintings will thematically be about gardens as a place of paradise. But you know, gardens in classical texts and classic myth or mythologies, there are these peaceful places where heroes were unawarely restful. And as a literary device, they served as the calm before the storm. Like the moment before the craziest, like shit, you know, like the climax. So like, I think seeing garden as this place that is both peaceful, but also a forewarning about something that is to happen. If you actually read Genesis from the Old Testament, and then read like the origins of like Greek gods and stuff, like they're like the Greek mythology version of creationism, like it's like very similar. Like it's like uncanny how similar it is.
I'm gonna whip out my King James Bible tonight before bed, and I'm gonna hop in. It's just for you, Hojay.
But I mean, I think aesthetically, think about like Bosch's, what is it, Garden of Earthly Delight,
right,
mixed with Piero della Francesca, mixed with Botticelli, and stuff like that. I think it'll be a cool I think it'll be
just the casual stuff like that. There's just a couple of nobodies from back in the day.
Yeah.
All right, Hoje, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us, or just me on Arts Mac. Jerry wasn't available this week. She's in Chicago, but she sends her love.
We miss you. We
miss you, Jerry. All right, buddy. Talk soon. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks, Matt.
All right, everybody. This has been episode 22 of Arts Mac. Yeah, 22. Thanks for listening to my talk with Hoje Kim. Hoje wanted me to mention that he has an artist talk coming up in May, early May. So make sure you follow his Instagram if you want to hear more from Hoje in the next few weeks. Also, there will be a new report coming out on Jerry Gagosian's website, gagosian.com. I mentioned that Jerry is in Chicago this week and she's in the middle of writing a report outlining the event. Jerry Report is always my favorite read, and I hope it's your favorite read too. So make sure you head over to gagosian.com and subscribe. All right, everybody. Take care. See you later.